Hello everyone, and welcome to the Ecosystemic Futures podcast, presented by SocianWorks, a global firm helping organizations and nations navigate ecosystemic transformation. As we advance towards a multiplanetary future, success depends not only on breakthrough technologies, but on the interconnected systems that support innovation and the human capabilities that drive it. Traditional approaches that separate infrastructure development from talent identification are insufficient for the scale of challenges we face in space exploration and national security. Today, we are exploring how entrepreneurial ecosystems and human potential assessment can be integrated into a unified framework for national resilience. We will examine how distributed innovation hubs can diversify supply chains in space. At the same time, advanced neuroscience helps identify and develop the minds capable of thriving in high-stakes, uncertain environments, from Earth-based defense applications to multiplanetary expansions. I'm Marco Annunziata, co-founder of Annunziata and SI Advisors, and today I am joined by Irina Czarzewska-Danilowska, founder and CEO of Space Coast Valley Earthport, and a PhD candidate in neuroentrepreneurship at the University of York. Irina is an entrepreneur, neurotech scientist, and space advocate working at the intersection of space innovation, neuroentrepreneurship, and startup ecosystem design. She is the founder and CEO of Space Coast Valley Earthport, an emerging hub near NASA Kennedy Space Center in Florida, focused on diversifying supplier ecosystems, strengthening regional innovation, and supporting startups in the space and life sciences industries. She is a serial entrepreneur and angel investor who has co-founded accelerators and innovation programs across Europe and North America, and she has mentored more than 600 entrepreneurs and judged over 40 international startup competitions. She was the first invited speaker from North Macedonia at Stanford University, and she has led NASA's Space Apps Challenge for a decade in multiple US and European locations. She's now a PhD candidate at the University of York, and we'll talk about it, with research in applied neuroscience, which explores the behavioral and neural markers of entrepreneurial success. And Irina has a ton of recognitions under her name, including ICT Women Entrepreneur of the Year, industry leader by the UN Women Changing the Rules of the Game, and Women Entrepreneurial Leader by the International Council for Small Businesses, and a lot more. She's also an alumna of Singularity University's Global Solution Programs. Irina, I'm delighted to have you on the podcast. It's hard to do justice to your CV in a few minutes. So welcome, and why don't you start by telling us and the audience a little bit more about your journey?
Thank you, Marco, for the invitation. As you said, I have spent the last 20 years mainly around building startup ecosystems, both across the US and in Europe. I have my biggest experience lies in Silicon Valley. I have been part of different programs working with over 600 entrepreneurs globally, but I was also part of the very dynamic and thriving Silicon Valley ecosystem. I was living in the startup houses. I was working with mentors, with investors, with the VC funds, and we learned the good, bad, and ugly of the entrepreneurial ecosystem. My first encounter with Florida, where I'm building now the Space Coast Valley Earthport, is from 2015, when I came on a NASA award, and I actually could see a launch of a rocket. It kind of started from there. And it drive pulled me more and more towards supporting space startups and deep space entrepreneurs. However, over the years and working with these entrepreneurs and mentors, I was able to see early successes, people that was able to sustain the journey over a lot of encounters over a longer period of time, while others who received a lot of funding through to friends and connections actually stalled and didn't carry out their missions. So some early patterns emerged. So this was one of the reasons that I actually got interest into neuroentrepreneurship and learning more about how people succeed, which are the ones that succeed under uncertainty and when conditions change. So kind of I'm on a journey that converges and merges these two paths between building ecosystems as infrastructure on one side, and on the other side, identifying and building the people and the teams that can carry the humanity forward.
It's fascinating. So you've had a fascinating journey so far, and it's, in a sense, it's barely started. And I love this interaction, this intersection of ecosystems with the attention to human entrepreneurship and human talent. It's one of the things I'm most passionate and concerned about at the moment, because I feel that in many ways we often get too excited about technology, and we're tending to underestimate the importance of human capital and human talent. So I'm glad that we have a possibility to explore this more in depth in our discussion. To kick it off now, Irina, let's look at the big picture. You've proposed that resilient innovation ecosystems are not just economic drivers, but they're also a part of how nations can secure their future in an era of fragile supply chains and ambitious space endeavors, which is very much top of mind now that we've entered an era of greater trade tensions, geofragmentation. So national security is top of mind for everybody. What has led you to identify this connection between distributed entrepreneurial hubs and national security infrastructure?
Yes, you are correct. When we talk about resilience in the US space program, the first thing people pictures are rockets and satellites. But true resilience actually isn't about hardware alone. It's about the ecosystems behind them. So right now, NASA depends on a handful of large primes. Those primes sit on top of complex networks of subcontractors they don't fully control. And yet, because each prime manages its own vertical stack, those networks operate like silos with little integration or redundancy across them. So we have seen this risk play out elsewhere too. For example, Europe's Ariane program suffered disastrous delay due to overdependence on a single supply chain, spilling over critical missions. So we have a paradox. On paper, it looks like the prime contractors have diversity, but in practice, it's concentration. So a single disruption, geopolitical, economic, or technological, and we need to know the current geopolitical situation in which we live in, can ripple across the entire space program. So imagine a mission delay or even jeopardized because one critical supplier missed a part or went offline. That's not just a technical delay, it's a national security risk. So I came to see this connection between ecosystem and security because of my own career. As I mentioned, I have built accelerator programs and watched ecosystems rise and fall across the US and Europe. The regions that thrived were always the ones with broad entrepreneurial bases, distributed and adaptive talent, and layered supply chains, not those that dependent on just a few big players. So that's why I argue for distributed entrepreneurial hubs. They turn a fragile stack of silos into a resilient national security infrastructure, reducing risk and ensuring we out-innovate competitors in space and on Earth.
It's a compelling argument and a compelling logic. And I'd love to talk with you through the steps of how we actually build this better, more distributed and more resilient ecosystems and supply chains. In this framework, your Space Coast Valley Earthport represents a new model for space industry development, right? So walk us through how this distributed approach differs from the traditional one, from the traditional development models. And essentially, you know, you've identified in your previous answer the weaknesses of the traditional approach. How can institutions like NASA and other organizations move beyond it and build these more resilient ecosystemic approaches?
So traditional aerospace has been structured around a very large primes that worked for Apollo and Shuttle. But in today's environment, with geopolitical uncertainty, fragile international supply chains, and rapid tech turnover, it has becoming a vulnerability. So right now, for example, Florida companies sometimes wait 6 months for a part from California, only to receive the wrong part. Wow. That's unacceptable. So the model that we are proposing with the Space Coast Valley Earthport will flip the script. So we're developing it as distributed, modular, and replicable. Instead of one long centralized supply chain, we are creating regional hubs co-located with NASA centers. So each hub will be tied to its nearest NASA center, intentionally embedding teams, startups, and small businesses with the right capabilities directly into the supply chain. We expect this to result in a shorter lead times, lower cost, tighter quality control, and increase the resilience. In other words, to create efficiency and speed that match the pace of today's space race. And it doesn't stop at exploration. These hubs will be designed for three domains: solutions that work in space, terrestrial, and ocean environments. And with each domain, they also unlock dual-use pathways across civilian and defense markets. That diversification strengthens both economic resilience and national security. Taken together, these hubs will create a national innovation architecture, where each regional ecosystem fits into the broader U.S. space program. So this isn't just an economic win. It will be a strategic imperative. Diversifying NASA's supply chain will reduce national vulnerability, ensure faster adaptation, and will strengthen America's ability to compete globally.
So, Irina, you've described the Space Coast Valley Earthport as a resilience platform, something that is modular, distributed, and replicable. For our NASA audience, managing complex supply chains and international partnerships, can you tell them how does this model create systemic resilience rather than just additional capacity? Because I think you hinted at it before, but I think it's worth going more in depth in explaining how these dedicated regional hubs that you are describing really create systemic resilience, and they're not just a creation of additional capacity.
The distinction that is critical in the traditional aerospace model: adding capacity, as you mentioned, often just means adding another supplier into the same long, brittle chain. That doesn't change the risk profile. It just lengthens the pipeline. So Space Coast Valley Earthport and the other hubs that will be similar to it will be different. It will flip the model from dependency to resilience. So each hub will be designed to be self-contained and tied directly to its nearest NASA center, like Kennedy, Johnson, Huntsville, Ames, or Goddard. Whatever a center needs, in that case, will be able to produce locally, not by a single vendor, but by several startups and small businesses in parallel. That will create redundancy at the source. So if one supplier falters, another will be able to step in. And if for some reason, none of the local innovators can deliver, the system still has that distributed backup. So other Earthport hubs across the country will be able to step in seamlessly because they will be connected by a national innovation architecture. So it's not just extra capacity, it's distributed redundancy and resilience by design. And it's not only supplier level redundancy, it will be also team redundancy that will improve too. So each hub will develop multiple teams with overlapping capabilities. For example, guidance, life support, robotics. So one team sleeps, another can search without losing program tempo. The Earthport model also strengthens international partnerships by giving key global allies a physical presence in the US, co-locating their production facilities and teams alongside NASA centers, so collaboration can happen in real time, embedded in the ecosystem rather than managed from afar. So for NASA and its international partners, this is mission assurance in action. There will be no more 6 months delays waiting for a part ship across the country. No more single points of failure hidden inside prime subcontractor stacks. And instead, with this model, we can get faster response times, parallel innovation tracks, and built-in fallback options. So that's how Earthport turns a fragile chain into a resilient ecosystem, one designed to deliver under pressure, whether for exploration or for national security.
It's an extremely convincing argument. Irina, I'm going to switch gears now and switch to a question that I was initially going to ask you earlier, but I was keen on delving into the details of this more distributed ecosystem approach, and especially the Space Coast Valley Earthport that you've now described in detail. But I want to go back to bring in the other side of your work, which is the human potential assessment and your work on behavioral and neural markers. So let me ask you this. Your work has spanned from building physical innovation campuses near the NASA Kennedy Space Center to researching the neural markers of entrepreneurial successes. This dichotomy, this two-pillar approach you emphasized at the very beginning. How did you come to realize that ecosystemic development and human potential assessment need to be treated as integrated rather than as separate domains?
You're right. My career seems split into two tracks on a first look. And on one side, I was building accelerator programs and running these deep tech innovation challenges across the US and Europe. And also most recently, launching the Space Coast Valley Earthport. But also on the other side, I'm pursuing a PhD in neuroentrepreneurship, studying the behavioral and neural markers of entrepreneurial success. But the reason that I actually started the doctorate was precisely because I saw something was broken. Across the US and Europe, the investment and selection systems were flawed, often driven by networks and biases while overlooking capable founders. So that's when the integration became obvious. I began to see ecosystems and people as a single system, where infrastructure and human adaptability evolve together. To me, now they are inseparable. Ecosystems without the right team are empty shells, and brilliant minds without supportive ecosystems either burn out, get overlooked, or move away. So my ecosystems and minds resilience framework makes this clear. Resilient ecosystems reduce systemic risk, while resilient minds reduce the human error. And together, they'll give us adaptive capacity, the ability to out-innovate and outlast our competitors in space and on Earth. That is why I'm advocating for intentional and parallel investment in both ecosystem infrastructure design and maximizing human potential. And this is actually what we are working on in Florida.
Let's stay on this human lens of neuroentrepreneurship and talent system, which I think is especially fascinating. And I want to talk a little bit more about your PhD research, which, as I understand it, it analyzes behavioral and neural markers across three groups: successful startup founders, corporate managers, and aspiring entrepreneurs. Can you tell the audience a bit more about your PhD research, and in particular, how it's structured and what patterns have started to emerge and how that could change how space agencies and defense organizations identify and develop high potential leaders?
Before starting the PhD, when I was working actively in the ecosystem development and helping the startups, and also working with investors, helping them to select the right startups, I was very much interested of the science behind that. And I was trying to read and to find papers and research materials in this area that will show some path forward, what will be the best way to do this. However, what's been missing was that most of the studies were small, single countries, and used students and students proxies. And I get that. It's really hard to get high-level entrepreneurs to answer your question or nevertheless sit on a EEG session when you connect to them 128 sensors. But I was already embedded in the ecosystems, in the startup ecosystems. So I felt that I should do something. I should use my connections and I should use my knowledge, personal knowledge with these people so I can bring in big group of respondents. So I managed over a period of 5 years to actually gather 10,000 participants, 6,000 of them successful startup founders, 2,000 corporate managers from Fortune 500 and Europe 500 companies, as well as aspiring entrepreneurs. So I was able to create and to validate markers that were not available before. For example, even the Big Five personality framework that is one of the most widely used tools for assessing individual potential explains only 10% of the variance in what contributes to a startup founder's success, because it measures broad traits in the general population rather than context-specific capacities. So I designed my research differently. First, very big base of respondents across 80 countries, but then also very high criteria what represent successful startup founders. We were taking investment metrics, market metrics in order to select these participants. After this, through exploratory and confirmatory factor analysis, we were able to identify the construct adaptive capacity under uncertainty, which is composed of 6 validated dimensions explaining 71% of the success variance, which is very high. Of course, it can never be 100 because it's always the other part is sometimes luck, sometimes market conditions, sometimes investment support. However, being able to base 70% of the outcome on the individual performance and individual characteristics, it's huge. It will be a game changer. These components are relentless resilience, value-creating opportunism, intrinsic curiosity, courageous decision-making, strategic innovativeness, and transformational leadership. And we have very specific scale how we measure these behavioral markers. One of the main findings was that successful startup founders score very positively across all these dimensions, while even very successful corporate managers, although they were positively related to leadership and resilience, this was still much less than the successful startup founders. And they were also significantly weaker in intrinsic curiosity and value creation. So this painted a different picture and distinguished between successful startup founders and CEOs. On the other side, the group of aspiring entrepreneurs showed negative association overall as a group, which highlighted that the entrepreneurial intent alone isn't enough. So there was only a very small subset, like 3-5% of everyone that claimed that they want to be successful entrepreneurs that actually had that traits at the beginning. So we continue to look into how we can train this and which of this subset of people actually will be trainable in order to further develop this model. But crucially, this isn't about the perfect individuals. It's about team design, pairing complementary profiles so the team's decision-making, exploration, and execution stay strong across stress and time.
It's fascinating. I mean, first of all, I'm impressed because, as you pointed out, you've worked with a sample of subjects in your research, which is both huge in terms of numbers. 10,000 is a very, very large number of participants, and it's very specific, very selected. So that makes the results of the research especially compelling, especially significant, and very, very interesting. And I also love your comment that what you're looking for is not perfect individuals. In line with your emphasis on ecosystem, this is aimed at building the right team. It's also what you're pioneering here is neuroentrepreneurship as a framework for identifying people who can also thrive under uncertainty. And we talked a lot about uncertainty when you were discussing earlier the buildup of these ecosystemic supply chains. Now, in space missions where human error can be catastrophic, decision making happens under high uncertainty and in extreme environments. How do you think these insights can help transform the crew selection and team formation?
Yes, the neuroentrepreneurship will give us a mission level way to compose crews and ground teams with complementary strengths. So instead of asking who is the smartest, we'll ask which combination of our markers makes this team safer and more adaptive. For example, a crew commander profile often blends relentless resilience plus transformational leadership. So he'll be able to hold cohesion and tempo under stress. On the other side, a mission specialist type will benefit from intrinsic curiosity and strategic innovativeness, which will have structured exploration with operational pragmatism. It's what he will bring on the table. And on the other side, a flight director, for example, archetype, will lean on courageous decision-making. We want him to lean on courageous decision-making and value-creating opportunism so he can make decisive actions and rapid course correction when it's needed. So because this scale is a quantitative instrument validated on a real-world findings, It supports team design, and it's also covering the blind spot, balancing exploration and exploitation, and aligning people to roles they're naturally built to excel in. So in long duration missions, this will translate directly to fewer factors, human factors failures, better anomaly response, and higher mission assurance. It will also enable targeted training. If a crew shows a gap in, say, adaptive decision making, we can train to it before launch rather than discover it during an EVA.
It's fascinating. You know, you've hinted now at something else that I find interesting, which is you've put the accent on the importance of looking at a complementary set of skills and abilities in order to build the right teams. You've also mentioned, we discussed the importance of high performance in a stress environment, especially on space missions. And I know you've also explored the importance of neuroplasticity research in zero gravity and microgravity environments. And I'm wondering, how might insights from space-based neuroscience help us enhance performance for entrepreneurs, astronauts, and defense leaders operating in high-stakes terrestrial environment? How do you see this dichotomy between, or complementarity between, the insights applied to these two kind of environments, space and Earth?
Just before answering that, I would like to shortly reflect on my EEG part of my research. So the identification of the neuro markers, where we observed consistent differences between the different participants. So for example, the successful leaders would process visual options faster. They'll categorize alternatives more actively and resolve conflicts much more effectively. And we'll also evaluate opportunities much better than the others. And once they make the decision, they tend to commit to that decision and they are confident to lead with that. So as we move forward, what this can mean for NASA and for Space Force or Department of Defense, it can go in two ways. One is operational telemetry, which is near term, when we move forward through miniaturization and wearables. So instead of 128 sensor rigs, we'll move toward lightweight, fit-for-purpose devices integrated into training and simulation, then extended into analogs and eventually missions. So this turns potential into operational metrics, like athletes, biometrics, but for cognitive adaptability. And for continuous development, midterm, we can integrate those metrics into a closed loop training stack. So biofeedbacks plus decision drills plus after action learning. So over time, build a privacy preserving and anonymized benchmark, which we called the Earthport Index, that will help agencies, primes, and investors to spot high adaptability talent and assemble high reliability team. But moving this to microgravity, what I can say is that microgravity is a natural stress test for the brain. So the sensor integration, motor planning, time perception, all core systems adapt. So if we treat orbit and lunar analogs as living labs for neuroplasticity, we can prototype protocols that boost adaptive capacity under uncertainty when conditions shift. So drawing from our EEG work, showing enhanced markers in successful founders during uncertain tasks, these protocols could also assess for similar neural efficiency in extreme environments, translating to docking maneuvers of nominal EVA calls and complex coalitions operation on Earth. So to your questions, how this two-way works between space and Earth, Earth trains for space and space discoveries feed back to Earth, shortly speaking. So, for example, protocols that help astronauts sustain performance in microgravity, for example, via neurofeedback targeting improvement of attention and conflict resolution, can also enhance decision-making, stress recovery, and focus for defense leaders, surgeons, or startup founders on Earth, improving their collective focus, anomaly response, and team handoffs under pressure. Another way around, Earth to space, using wearables to assess biofeedback parameters, cognitive load, and decision under uncertainty drills, we will be able to prepare crews and control teams for microgravity-driven cognitive shifts before they even fly. So this is how a neuroscience-informed talent system can improve both exploration and national security. Of course, it needs to be done ethically and voluntarily with privacy by design in order to become team optimization capability that will reduce human factor failures, and it will improve the overall mission assurance across different domains.
It's fascinating. And it's, as you said, the privacy, the voluntary aspect is important, but it's very powerful because, as you have highlighted, it's a quantitative approach. It's a very rigorous approach. So it's an extremely scientific and rigorous assessment of talent, skills, and capabilities that are now, that are then extremely, extremely relevant and crucial in especially high pressure and high stakes environments. So this strikes me as something that could really be a game changer in terms of how organizations can build teams for these high stakes missions and situations.
Yes, just going to that point, if I may add, it will change the planning horizon. So for example, in aerospace, we know that people often think about hardware redundancy, but they don't always think about human redundancy. So with the research that I just shared, we show that entrepreneurial resilience and high-tech leaders' resilience can be measured, just like hardware reliability, just as you mentioned. So when we integrate that lens into ecosystem planning, we can stop thinking of people just as a soft variable and start treating them as a measurable contributors to mission assurance. So I hope that this will not sound rough, but we can codify people performance and capacity as part of the mission assurance. So crew console composition matrices, predefined role redundancies, and escalation playbooks for off nominal events reviewed like any hardware risk. So for long missions, that will mean designing ecosystems where resilient supply chains and resilient teams will evolve together. So if you plan only for the rocket, but not for the people, or only for the people, but not for the ecosystem, you'll miss the real source of adaptive capacity. Strategic planning must now account for both. So practically what this means, this can create three level of shifts. The first one, ecosystem redundancy on the level of suppliers. So for each critical component of software part, we can plan for multiple regional sources tied to the nearest NASA center with predefined search capacity and sibling hubs. So we are not just adding vendors, but we are architecting a distributed network with measurable time to recover and time to adapt targets. On the human side, with this, we're also creating human redundancy. So using the adaptability markers. So moving from generic headcount, these agencies will be able to go to adaptive capacity per crew flight control team. So they'll be able to use the behavioral and neural markers to ensure that every team has redundancy across resilience, decisive action, under uncertainty, and strategic innovativeness. Then track this like any other key performance parameter. And when we'll synchronize these upgrades, for example, when a program adds a new launch cadence or deep space capability, the local hub supplier bench and the team's adaptive capacity are expanded in the same plan. So in other words, no major hardware milestone will be able to be delivered without a matching ecosystem plus human milestone. That's how we can design adaptive capacity into multi-year timelines rather than hope for them.
There is something you said which I think is very interesting. And as you were referring to the idea of measuring in a very scientific way the resistance, resilience, and failure risk of humans the way we do with hardware. And I can see why you made this comment that this might sound hard. And if there are people in our audience who feel that it's excessively harsh to speak of human participants in missions and programs the way we speak about machines, I would make the observation that this is already what happens in the world of sports, where whether you're looking at soccer or baseball or basketball, there are very scientific measurements being made exactly to measure the performance and resistance and injury risk of individual players, exactly along the lines that you were describing. That is, to recognize that there are quantifiable characteristics that can be measured and that should be factored into how the human capital is deployed. So it's actually not as harsh as it might sound. It's actually a more thoughtful approach to measuring, assessing, and then safeguarding the human capital, in my mind. Would you agree?
Yes, definitely, because these are really key people that we are putting on these kinds of position going into space. So you cannot just create a team that doesn't have this capacity as a whole with these complementary roles that they need to fill in. So actually, by making sure that they have everything they need and that they are at the peak brain performance and that they are ready, that they're rested, that they're operating optimally, it actually safeguards the safety, but also the mission safety. We cannot allow any other way for that kind of critical missions to be performed. But what's more exciting about the neuroscience technologies in tools is that it's not only the assessment part. They also can provide the training part through a neurofeedback protocols. So whatever is identified pre-mission as missing in some of the team members, they can be trained for that. And then while they are in space, especially on a longer duration mission, their performance and team performance will be assessed. And if there is any weak points in the team, that will be addressed, and which is, I believe, much better approach than that kind of incidents escalating and without having idea that some of the team members have any problem or issue to perform at their maximum capacity. You mentioned people in sports, but the same, for example, with surgeons, with formula drivers, everywhere where that peak performance is needed, we need to have these kinds of metrics that will ensure safety of everyone involved.
Absolutely right. Irina, I'd like to jump to the issue of financing. You've mentioned earlier in our conversation that by living directly in the Silicon Valley ecosystem, you've observed the differences also in not just in entrepreneurship styles, but also in where financing and funding goes. So we've observed that traditional venture capital and government funding often rely on networks and subjective assessments rather than evidence-based selection. I think this is something you've personally observed as well. How do you think that neurological and behavioral markers could help create more intentional, more effective approaches to where the funding goes? So to make sure that the funding goes to backing high potential space entrepreneurs and innovators.
So this is one of the biggest inefficiencies in innovation today. Billions are deployed each year and often driven by who you know rather than who can actually deliver under pressure. And I have seen this times and times firsthand where high potential founders were overlooked just because they didn't have the warm intro to the right investors. So with neuroentrepreneurship and neuroscientific assessment tools, we can replace that investors' gut intuition or their networks with evidence. So by using validated behavioral tasks and neural markers, we can identify the traits that matter most for high-stakes innovations. Investors and agencies can then make intentional choices. Fund the founders and teams with demonstrated adaptability, not just the ones with the right network. So, for example, imagine also a future where SBIR funding and NASA accelerators or Space for Technology programs also include neuroentrepreneurship assessment alongside the technical merit. That would focus scarce resources from public and private investors on people with the greatest probability of success, multiplying the return on every dollar that is invested. So this approach will turn selection from network-driven to evidence-driven. We now have tools to measure adaptability under uncertainty, as I said, which will be a real differentiator in volatile missions in space, but also in volatile market conditions on Earth. And with this, we can enable the investors to select earlier with a much lower risk. So they'll be able to fund the founders and mission leaders who score high on the traits that matter in high-stake environment, not just those with the right profile. Then also design the role fit teams. We'll be able to compose teams and program offices and flight crews that are intentionally complementary, reducing the human factor failure points, both on Earth and in space. Because we need first to find the leader of the team, but if we don't pair him with the right operational team, again his success could be lower. And finally, we'll be able to target the investors and the space agencies and the defense agencies will be able to target the development resources. So if a candidate shows a gap in adaptive decision making or prescribed, they'll be able to prescribe a focused training protocol before giving them a critical role, connecting to what we spoke also before. This will improve the return on every American dollar. It will raise the mission assurance simultaneously. And will also ensure that the return of investment will be much higher for the investors, knowing that the current numbers are really low of how many startups receive investment compared to actually how many startups succeed.
It's a very important insight that you gave there, Irina, because when we look at innovation, too often we tend to focus on the big success stories, the unicorns, the technologies that end up being life-changing. And we're all familiar with the idea that often in the venture capital world, the approach is to take risk knowing that many of your investments will fail. But I don't think people appreciate sufficiently the point you have made, which is that the underlying way in which capital funding is directed is very, very inefficient because it doesn't have so far a sufficiently well-developed quantitative background. So this, I think it's an extremely, extremely important point that you have made, and I hope that the audience will take it to heart in terms of the importance of deploying capital efficiently. It has to be done based on quantitative criteria, and you've made a very, very powerful case for this. I want, if I may, Irina, switch to looking at the broader and longer term strategic visions, especially for space programs. So as space activities expand gradually from low Earth orbit to lunar bases and eventually to Mars missions, we have in front of us an evolving and growingly ambitious scale of overly ambitious project in terms of both timeline and scale of projects. So my question is, how do we design innovation ecosystems that can gradually evolve and scale across these different operational environments and time scales? You've made a case, a very clear case before, on how your ecosystemic approach provides better resilience for existing projects. What is the best way to ensure that these resilience and adaptabilities carry over as the projects become more and more ambitious?
Yes, you're right. Based on the latest developments, the next 10 years will be unlike anything we have seen so far. So the new space race is already here, not only between nations, but also between competing models of how innovation happens. So Artemis 2, it was just announced today, is preparing to return humanity to the moon. SpaceX is also pushing aggressively toward Mars. Mars Blue Origin's New Glenn is coming online to expand heavy lift capacity. And also in the same time, multiple commercial players are racing to build the private space stations. So why I'm mentioning this? This means that the systems that we built now, both human and technological and ecosystemical will define how resilient and adaptive we are when exploration pushes into truly uncharted territory, because we are at the beginning of these new bold explorations. So the key is to recognize that the technologies alone don't scale. We need ecosystems that will scale these technologies. For example, the US has extraordinary research underway. For example, the University of Central Florida's work on simulating and testing regolite for in-situ lunar mining and construction, or institutes in Europe like the German Research Center for Artificial Intelligence, developing robotics that can operate in both space and subsea environments. These are unique capabilities, but they often remain siloed in labs or in the minds of innovators without the structures to carry them into markets or missions. So that's where ecosystem design comes in. At Space Coast Valley Earthport, as ecosystem builders and teams optimizers, our job is to pair researchers who have breakthroughs with engineers, entrepreneurs, mentors, and investors, so they can shape them together into scalable solutions. The architecture we are designing is designed for that pairing: co-located research base, startup prototyping labs, investors access, on-site living areas, and mission integration offices under one roof. And we did this with a triple domain dual use lens. Every capability must show pathways across space, earth, and oceans, and within each domain to find both civilian and defense market. With this layered approach, is very intentional. It makes technologies more sustainable and investable over decades. So the ecosystem is what will translate breakthrough into adoption. It will ensure unique technologies don't die on the vine, but instead find growth teams and multiple pathways across operational environments and timescale. Leo today, lunar bases tomorrow, Mars in the decades to come. So that's how we can maximize the return on national and allied research, not by duplicating the lab work, but as the ecosystem builders, to orchestrate the teams, the capital, and the infrastructure to scale it into missions and markets.
It's an outstanding, Irina. We're coming towards the end of our conversation. I want to end with an ambitious look ahead and get a sense, or give our audience a sense of how you're looking at the future and what excites you. So as you look ahead to the next decade of space exploration, and you've hinted just now that it's going to be unlike anything we have seen before, the ambitions are growing stronger and stronger. There is also a layer of growing complexity of international space cooperation. Against this background, again, looking at the next 10 years or longer, what excites you the most about the possibilities for creating yet more resilient and adaptive approaches to the innovation ecosystem development?
They said the next decade will be very exciting, especially for the young people that are now at universities or they're in the early careers as scientists, as engineers, because after 50, 60 years, actually, humanity has the real possibility to go back on Moon and hopefully soon on Mars. So basically, the ones that are like teenagers today or young adults will be the ones living through this next decade and decades of truly uncharted territories, where we are going to see and deploy a lot of the technologies that so far were developed on Earth or scaled and tested in a small, in just the simulators. However, what excites me the most is that we are finally moving beyond the myth that only big primes can deliver. The next decade, I also believe that is about distributed innovation, where startups, small businesses, and research teams worldwide will feed into missions through structured, resilient ecosystems, and that the current students and researchers will actually diversify NASA and prime suppliers' ecosystems through these regional innovation hubs that we are pioneering. And if we pair that with advances in the neuroscience, we can also intentionally identify and support the people and the teams who will thrive in those missions. And for me personally, the Space Coast is the perfect launchpad for this future. And it's what makes me the most excited, since the Space Coast is the place where America first reached the moon, where the shuttle era inspired generation, and where today's commercial renaissance is taking off. If we can prove the Earthport model here, linking infrastructure with human potential, we can then replicate it across NASA centers, across allied nations, and eventually across worlds, building resilient supply chains for long-duration space missions. So now we have that road ahead where we are locking new partnerships, where we are adding new investors, bringing in new startups, and we are open with everyone who have ideas or want to be part of this journey to join us on our mission. That way, we are going to create not just resilient ecosystem, but also architecture of a resilient civilization, one that can adapt, innovate, and learn from low Earth orbit to lunar bases to Mars and beyond.
This is a great note to end our conversation on. And let me just stress that I think our audience will have realized that your approach of combining ecosystemic development of organizations together with attention to neuroentrepreneurship as a way to measure, identify, nurture, build, and safeguard the human talent is one of the most powerful approaches that I've heard recently, and one of the most powerful approaches that we can look forward to push the frontiers of science, innovation, and entrepreneurship. So, Irina Chaujevska-Danilovska, thank you so much for being with us today. It's been a great conversation with lots of insights. Thank you so much.
Thank you so much as well.
And thanks, everybody, for joining us today as we explored how integrating entrepreneurial ecosystem development with neuroentrepreneurship research can create new frameworks for national resilience and for success in space exploration. Please check out this season's episodes as we continue examining how systems thinking can transform our approach to complex challenges from Earth orbit to Mars and beyond. Follow us, subscribe on Apple Podcasts or whatever your preferred podcast platform is, and you can learn more at shoshinworks.com. Thank you, everybody.